I mean, I really liked Help and I really liked Hard Day's Night, but something about the Beatles' performance in Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I just don't like as much.
It's probably because it's not the Beatles.
Well, I know they spell it different. They spell it B-E-A-T-L-E-S, but like they're still the Beatles.
No, it's not the Beatles. It's the Bee Gees.
Oh, good God. We should stop the music right now.
You can't stop the music.
We can't stop the music.
You just can't stop the music. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Out the sheet music and the sheet cake, junkies. It's time for another installment of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film podcast that conducts symphonies of affection for the forgotten cinematic concertos. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, undefeated champion of the disco rink, and I am joined by my skating doubles partner, screenwriter slash novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, everybody.
Cargill, you're going to like today's show a lot.
I'm going to love today's show a lot.
This is basically the Cargill trifecta.
This is kind of the Cargill trifecta. It kind of is where I have my holy trilogy. Everyone has their holy trilogy. And my holy trilogy, as I've talked about several times, is, you know, Krull, Battle Beyond the Stars, and Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And they're all tied together by the music, which is done by James Horner.
James Horner, right.
This trifecta is also tied together by music, but they are three of my favorite awesomely awful musicals that have both great and awful stuff tied into them.
This is more like his unholy trilogy, and that's exactly what we're going to get into tonight. But before we do that, I want to remind you guys that we are available on iTunes and on Stitcher as well. If you don't do the whole iTunes thing, you can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema.
And if you really like the show, I mean really like, I can't do Cargill. This is your day friendly neighborhood editor, Meryl Barr. And, you know, this was an episode recorded well before I joined the show, well before we had a Patreon. So before we move further, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. You guys know the drill. Go there, sign up, all the good stuff, bonus episodes, whatever. Also, we have a Tee Public store. We got merch. It's awesome. junkfoodcinema.com/store. Get us all your merch needs, pillows, tote bags. Yes, you could be resting your head on the faces of Brian and Cargill, and how awesomely creepy is that?
And all the movies we're going to be talking about tonight, we will have Amazon links at the bottom of the page. If you'd like to, well, for the things you can actually buy,
yes.
One of the movies in particular, you won't be able to, but for the ones you can, we will have Amazon links. And if you want to buy it, please do click on our link to get to Amazon to do that, because that benefits us and we really do appreciate it. So as we mentioned, today we are getting all melodious up in here and we're celebrating those bizarre and wonderful musicals that struck an odd chord with us in the best way possible. We're really only covering a 3-year period here.
Yeah. No, there's an odd thing that happened in the 70s. And, you know, music is probably what the 70s is best known for. You know, music followed by its fashion. And disco, disco was a movement. It was more than just a music movement. It was a cultural movement, which then saw several years later a huge snapback.
Right.
And an infamous snapback that culminated with, you know, a famous burning and exploding of disco vinyls in Yankee Stadium. It was a huge event where people were lashing out against the subculture that had evolved, and it was such a weird subculture that seeped into everything. And what ended up happening were two movies came out, both starring John Travolta. One was Saturday Night Fever, which was about the disco era,
right?
And the second was Grease. And these were such big cataclysmic hits that all of a sudden everyone was trying to duplicate it and trying to find ways to get music and disco to be a centerpiece in their films. And unfortunately for some of the films we're going to talk about tonight, two of them in particular, they were released just after the big infamous blowing up, you know, and there were a number of films affected by this, because films take a long time to go through the process. You know, it's not just making the movie, but you got to edit, you got to polish, you got to release date. Even back in the old school days, this was, you know, serious business. And several of these movies got left in, you know, a wasteland of disco hate.
It was the fallout of disco dying harder than John Malkovich in Con Air.
Yes, that is exactly what it is. And it's one of those weird periods in which you end up with a number of really amazing misfires. And we're going to talk about three of those misfires, because these films, you know, we normally talk about, you know, that we're irony free. And
we try to be as much as possible. It's one of the tenets of this show.
But tonight, there's a bit of irony, because the thing is, part of what makes these films magical are just how bad they are and how enjoyably bad they are. But what makes them magical is that the parts of them that work really, really work.
It's true. There is still a lot of quality to be mined. So we're gonna divulge a little bit in our irony, but it's like a low-grade irony. It's more like nickel-y or tin-y. It's not quite all the way irony, but there is going to be a little bit of that on this show.
But so, a little background, Tim League gives a number of the film critics in town a theater for their birthday to show a film of their choice. And I've been taking him up on this for years now. And two of the movies that I have shown are on the list for tonight. And I don't announce, you know, many of us here in town, we don't announce what we're showing in advance, because, you know, if you do, sometimes your friends are like, I don't know if I want to watch that.
I couldn't be assured that people were going to show up for Alligator when I showed it for my birthday.
Yeah, because how many times have we seen Alligator? But you go.
That's why.
I mean, that's the thing, is sometimes, you know, we have a friend here in town who showed Top Gun recently and like was, hey, look, I'm going to show one of my favorite 80s movies. And so, you know, you go primed for that. And then he pulls out Top Gun. Now, had he said, hey, I'm going to show Top Gun, you'd be like, well, I've seen Top Gun and I know Top Gun by heart. Do I really need to watch it again? But if you keep it kind of secret, it kind of builds up the mystique and the fun, and everybody walks in and has no idea what they're showing. I notoriously show unspeakably awesome bad movies.
Awesomeful.
And, yeah. I showed Sorceress, which, of course,
I remember.
Not until this summer was finally on DVD and Blu-ray. It was only on VHS. So it was the only way most people had seen it. Then, you know, after that, I also showed Phenomena. Not Phenomenon, Phenomena, the wonderful, brilliant Dream Logic Argento film, which
the
is
only the Argento that feels like a Fulci.
Yeah, it's the first full on-screen role. It's the first leading role of Jennifer Connelly, and has what I hold to be the single greatest revenge subplot of all time.
True story.
But so then I followed up the next 2 years. I showed two of the movies we're talking about tonight.
You got very musical the next couple of years.
I'm going to have to, you know, zig next year instead of zag, because it's how do you follow up those two movies? But we'll get into those. But first, let's talk about the one I haven't shown, because chiefly the American Genre Film Archive does not have a print of this, or else I probably would have shown it.
I think they should, though. I think this is a movie that, just based on the oddity of its existence alone, should be preserved. And what I love so much about it is we talk about movies sometimes that are misfires, and, you know, some of the time we talk about movies that failed despite having a great concept and just not delivering on a lot of promises. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, on the other hand, was a bad idea from the get-go.
You know, most people, you know, there's the hypothetical question, if you go back in time to any moment in history, where would you go? And most people are like, I'd go back and kill Hitler, which has spawned a whole series, a subgenre of writing about people who kill Hitler and bad things go wrong. Me, I would go back into the 70s to sit in the studio room when they pitched Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because I want to see the look on people's face when they say, okay, so we got the rights to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They're like, the album? Yes, we get to make a movie about the album. They're like, then the Beatles are cool with this? Yes, the Beatles are cool with it, because they don't really have the rights per se to all of this stuff. But we can't get the Beatles. They won't do the movie. That's like, oh, well,
then let's just not do the movie. Let's not do the movie.
No, because we don't have the Beatles, but we have the Beatles. G's. And it's like, oh, so you have all four brothers. No. The other brother, he's not going
to
be famous
so
for
who
a few
are we
years
gonna get,
yet.
Who are we going to get to fill in the fourth spot?
Peter Frampton.
Peter Frampton, who looks like a befuddled Q-tip throughout the entire movie.
And that alone, that concept alone, it's like, I have to see that movie. You know, it was. And oh, well, I've watched this for years. This was in heavy rotation when I was a film, a video clerk. But I would put this on regularly because it was just one of those films that, you know, I was able to show and it was available at every video store that I ever worked at.
Right.
And I developed a truly sick love for this film.
I would say that's apt, what you just said.
I discovered it, you know, back in the days, the very first video store job I had was at this great place here in town that's still around called I Love Video. And it is the underground indie store of underground indie stores that is constantly at war with Vulcan Video, where most of our friends work now.
Yep.
We have a bunch of friends that work at Vulcan Video, which is also amazing. But so, I was working at the store. I was, 24 years old, and I just started going through and learning entire genres. And it was just, at one point, I got a wild hair up my ass to visit and learn about all the musicals of the 70s. And you know Jesus Christ Superstar and Tommy and just learning and like what else is there. And so I'm going through the musical section and checking dates and run across Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band that I remembered fleetingly having seen as a child, and then put it on, and it just blew my mind, because what Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is an attempt to take an album.
Two
albums, and build a story out of it and have it be a pure musical where the story is told through the songs of these albums.
So you're really retconning a story to fit in with the titles and lyrics of these various songs. And it's actually a genre that I didn't even know there was a name for this type of musical. But it's called jukebox musical because it's not original songs that are written for the musical. It's taking established songs and then retconning your... I mean, this actually still exists. I mean, if you look at Movin' Out, which was all about Billy Joel's music, I saw one in Chicago.
Moulin Rouge.
I saw one in Chicago that was all Elvis music.
Oh, Mamma Mia is one of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very popular on Broadway. Rock of Ages was one, which turned into a movie that is
Rock Band, the movie. Yeah. Watching people play Rock Band, it's amazing.
But this is one of the, I don't want to say, it's definitely not the earliest, because this was something that happened way back in the 30s. You know, 30s and 40s musicals were built entirely on this concept. But this was one of the earlier modern versions of this, and was really kind of amazing. And what works about this, and what I love about this, is they have an amazing collection of musicians, various bands that perform all of these Beatles hits. So it is a film entirely made of Beatles covers. Now, a large portion of them are done by the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton, but then all these other amazing bands, most of whom are legendary now.
And I will say this, the best cover in the movie, in my opinion, is also the one that I feel like has lasted the test of time the most, and that's Aerosmith's Come Together.
Yes.
In fact, there's a whole generation of people growing up thinking that Aerosmith wrote Come Together.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is hands down the best song to come out of that. But, you know, you've got Earth, Wind, and Fire. Mm-hmm. You've got this crazy version of Maxwell Silverhammer performed by Steve Martin. Silverhammer came down on her head. Bang, bang, that's what Silverhammer made sure that she was dead. Which I like it better than the Beatles version. I get bad, ugly looks like I'm getting from you right now. It's such a weird, silly song. And he just kind of owns it in a way that's what I hear in my head.
Look, I didn't say that you were out of your mind. I'm just thinking it loudly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
No, I said I like it better. I didn't say it is better, because that would be wrong. Like, there's opinion and then there's wrong, and that would be wrong. I said I like it better. If that makes me wrong, then I'm happy to be wrong, and I know that I'm wrong, but I embrace that fact because I kind of fucking love this shit.
I'm gonna loop
Martin's Maxwell Silverhand.
I'm gonna loop what you just said about happy to be wrong, and I'm gonna play that at the beginning of every episode from now on.
That is fine. makes me wrong. That I'm happy to be wrong. And I know that I'm wrong. I'm wrong. 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 That is fine.
This is, to me, the prime example of what can go wrong when you have movie making by committee, or in this case, movie making by a record company executive. Because that's what this was. This is basically Robert Stigwood, who is the founder of RSO Records, going, well, we're going to make this movie with or without the Beatles using the songs of Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road. And you got to keep in mind, this is the guy that produced Saturday Night Fever and Grease.
Yeah.
So he was directly looking for that next big thing. And like I said, I think that not all... There's a danger in this. There's a danger in retconning the story around the songs because it doesn't always make the most sense. And I feel like when you take that and you put it in the 70s where cocaine is a food group,
it certainly is on the next film we'll talk about, but we'll get there.
Yes. I mean, this is why this movie is so off its damn rocker, is you have a concept that doesn't make a lot of sense other than a cash grab. You have casting that is beyond bizarre. And then you have copious amounts, piles upon piles, of pure uncut cocaine.
So much cocaine.
And then you end up with a film in which we have two Beatles songs performed by George Burns.
Yeah. Which is still not the oddest thing in the movie.
No. And that's what's so fucking wonderfully bizarre about this, is the reason I would put this movie on is because I just love the soundtrack. I mean, here you have these Beatles songs being covered by crazy choices sometimes. Mm-hmm. Really crazy. And then some really great ones. I mean, they're, you know, like I mentioned, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire and Aerosmith are easily two of the best covers in that entire album.
And Earth, Wind, and Fire is the only musical act in the movie that is allowed to have its own name. Every other musician in this movie is given some name that relates to a Beatles song, but Earth, Wind, and Fire, I just imagine, and I want to believe in my heart of hearts, just went in there and went, no, we're fucking Earth, Wind, and Fire, and we will remain Earth, Wind, and Fire. We are elements of the old world, and thus we shall remain.
Yes.
Because that's how they talk in my head.
Yeah. That's kind of how they talk on stage, too. I mean, I'm actually a big Earth, Wind, and Fire fan.
Oh, hell yeah.
So that song always gets me giddy when they come out on stage in the movie. And but yeah, it's the thing is as a narrative, the narrative is terrible.
Yes.
And sometimes it's funny how terrible it is.
Yeah. And it's saved. I'm going to spare you guys. If you don't want to be spoiled, don't listen to what I'm about to say. Nothing that happens in the plot matters one iota because it's all fixed by a magical black man at the end of the film.
Who just comes in and starts bringing the dead back to life and turning the bad guys into good guys.
Well,
and
turning them into Catholics, which is interesting. He turns all the bad guys into either priests, nuns, or the Pope.
Yeah.
And it's like, what?
Yeah, no, it's kind of amazing. It's, you know, the only other movie that I can think of that has a similar ending that functions like that and works is the pirate movie. Yeah, where all of a sudden, you know, we reveal that since we're in a dream, we can completely and utterly give the happy ending. And then they sing a song called Give Me a Happy Ending, where everybody ends up together and then she wakes up and gets her happy ending. But we'll talk about
that. Who doesn't like to wake up and have a happy ending?
We'll talk about that movie another day. Because we should.
We totally should.
We should. But yeah, it's this weird ending, and it really doesn't matter. And the storyline is just kind of lame to begin with.
True.
But
it's like, hey guys, the music industry is kind of corruptive. It's like, yeah, okay, we get
the,
that.
The story is entirely built, and obviously entirely built, to get us from song to song to song.
Right.
And Donald Pleasance.
I want you.
Not only shows up in this, he sings in this.
And has hair in this.
It's Dr. Loomis, people. Dr. Loomis sings in a movie. How have you not watched this movie?
Seriously, stop listening and watch this movie if you haven't. Because I don't know what was creepier, his singing or the fact that he had hair. But I do know that it very much sounded like Dr. Loomis singing, because he was just like, I want you. I want you so bad.
Michael,
I want you to have the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes.
I want you so bad. It's driving me mad.
Nope. Not playing that. Not doing it.
I just kept waiting for him to be like, the Beatles are gone from here. They're gone.
We couldn't get them. We tried 6 times. We couldn't get the Beatles. They're gone from here.
That's. I kept waiting for that to happen.
But it didn't.
It didn't. We haven't even tried to tell you guys what the plot of this movie is.
Because the plot of the movie is this. There's
here we go.
Once upon a time, there is a guy, and he leads the greatest band in history that plays music so great it changes the world. And then he dies. And
he's like the Winter Soldier of big bands.
Yeah, so he dies, and he and his band's instruments are left as relics, almost magical relics of this time. And then a young group of musicians comes to take on the mantle of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and they take the instruments, and they become as golden as their originator was.
Right.
And they instantly get signed to a huge record deal and go out to Hollywood and start dealing with the corruptive influence of Hollywood. And there's a villain involved who falls in love with the girlfriend of one of the
the girlfriend whose name is Strawberry Fields.
Named Strawberry Fields, of course. And
the bad guy is Mean Mr. Mustard.
And Mean Mr. Mustard steals all the instruments, and now the band needs to go and get their instruments back
from the various places, the various like sub villains that the instruments have been given to, all of whom are named after Beatles songs, which is how we get Steve Martin as Dr. Maxwell Hammer. And we get Alice Cooper as Father's son. And one of the craziest things about Alice Cooper in this movie is that at the time that it was shot, he was in rehab. He was in rehab for his alcohol addiction, and they signed him out for 3 days to go to this film set and play Father's son. Because if there's one place you want to be if you have an addictive personality, it's the set of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
And the weird thing is Alice Cooper's doing Frank Zappa.
Yes, like, exactly.
It's so weird because it's just like every time I see it, it's like, oh, I always forget Frank Zappa's in this. And it's like, duh, because Frank Zappa's not in this.
Yeah.
And that's Alice Cooper.
Yes.
And it's one of those you like laugh, but you when you're watching it, you're like, holy, oh, wait a second. No, because it really does fucking look like fucking Frank Zappa.
He does. In so many ways, he looks like Frank Zappa, and it's creepy.
And his number is awesome, too.
His number is awesome. And apparently he was going to attempt to sing his song like John Lennon would sing it. Like, he was going to attempt to imitate those vocals, and they were just like, no, just sing it the way Alice Cooper would. So, of course, it's, like, weird and sort of otherworldly, but it works.
Yeah. No, and that's what's so great about this movie is, and why you watch it, is you watch it because in terms of the music, it's fascinating music, and it's interesting choices for covers. There have been a number of movies that attempted covers of Beatles songs, most notably I Am Sam, which the soundtrack is entirely put together with Beatles songs. And it's just not the same. Like, right. Here, this is the most interesting collection of artists that have ever covered the Beatles put together. And it's just, and sometimes it's what the fuck. It's like George Byrne, When I'm 64. And it's like, dude, that was 30 years ago. come on, who are you kidding? Say goodnight, Gracie.
Will you still feed me when I was 64 a few years ago?
Yeah, but the thing is some of the numbers are so bad that you can't take your eyes off it, and then some of the numbers are just so good that you're just like, what is this doing here? This is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I actually love Aerosmith as, quote, future villain band doing Come Together, and I love that there was a controversy on set because Aerosmith found out that in the script, Peter Frampton was supposed to just out and out kill Steven Tyler. And Joe Perry was like, there's no fucking way that Peter Frampton is going to kill Steven Tyler. So they had to rework the script to where it's an accidental death, where like somebody else accidentally causes it, because they were so incensed by the idea that Peter Frampton could actually get one over on Steve Perry, which in the grand scheme of music, actually, I'm kind of in Aerosmith's corner on that.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess what I'm saying is I feel like they do. And now I'm getting the burning death stare. That's fine.
That means it's time to move on.
It's time to move on to our next movie. I guess we could say we could skate on into our next movie, which I will say, this is a movie that you introduced me to. And at first, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it. But the more I watched it in preparation for this show, the more I realized it is one of those disasters that I think just works so well for me. And that is a little movie called Skate Town USA.
Skate Town USA. Skate Town! This is a movie that most people don't know exists.
Because you can't find it anywhere but YouTube.
Yes. No, it was there. It has a long and storied history, but essentially this is one of those films that came out just a few months after the big disco explosion.
Specifically the roller disco explosion.
Yes. And it was a movie that just everything had collapsed. Nobody wanted to see a disco movie. But they had secured the rights to so many songs that were or would go on to be huge disco hits.
Right.
That when you watch this movie, you know every song but two by heart. Like every song but two in this movie, you fucking know because they've been in radio rotation for the last 35 years.
Well, I mean, you know, and then there's the songs by Boogie Master Dave Mason that might seem a little unfamiliar because
those are the two I'm talking about.
I was going to say because no one knows who the fuck Dave Mason is, even though they try to promote him in the movie as a huge star.
No. He had a big hit and I'm blanking on what his big hit was.
But it wasn't in the movie.
No. This was his comeback and when you try to come back in Skate Town USA, it just doesn't happen. So here is why this movie is an amazing oddity of history. It's not just because it has this amazing soundtrack and is a misfire of a movie. This movie is amazing because it's the first film of someone who would go on to be a honest-to-God A-list superstar product of an era.
Flip Wilson. Wait a minute. No,
this is the first movie with Patrick Swayze.
This is introducing Patrick Swayze. It literally says that in the credits.
Patrick Swayze, before he was an actor, was a professional award-winning roller skater.
We are going to need you to repeat that one
more time. He was a professional award-winning roller skater.
That's what I thought you said.
He won national tournaments. He was an amazing roller skater and was making his living doing that and was brought in to play the villain. Patrick Swayze is the villain of this movie.
The least intimidating villain ever.
He's the leader of a roller skating gang that runs the fucking roller rink. I mean, this
is... None of that made sense. None of those words you just put together gel.
Except that's the movie. I mean, okay, first of all, let's go back. Let's go back to when we open Skate Town USA. Skate Town USA is the name of the place. And this guy in this big, huge white Jufro and a wizard's robe...
Right.
Goes into the DJ booth, starts turning on the lights, waking everybody up because the staff sleeps at Skate Town USA.
Yeah, it's basically this utopian environment where everyone just lives, and that's the world that they operate in.
And then he points at the big ramp by the door where everyone comes out, and then magical lights shoot out of his hand because he is, in fact, a
wizard.
Disco wizard,
yeah.
Summoning the people and activating the club.
Yeah.
And that's our introduction to Skate Town. And from that point on, that makes the most sense in this fucking
movie.
He
casts the spell of hot pants and enrolls all of these nubile females on roller skates. And I want to say, do you know why he's a wizard specifically? I found this out. He's a wizard because this movie was made right after The Wiz made a bunch of money. So they thought, well, why don't we make him a wizard and then we'll have like that tie-in. It's like, yeah, that makes sense. Sure.
So the plot is there is this young hot skater who's coming to Skate Town to skate in the big contest. And
he's got this really badass name. His name is Stan.
Stan is the least interesting fucking part of this movie. You don't give a shit about him. You don't give a shit about him at all.
No, not at all.
However, his manager is kind of interesting because his manager is Scott Baio phoning it in and doing cocaine.
And this is before we found out what kind of a garbage human being Scott Baio really is.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's weird that an upstart roller skating... a roller skating upstart would have a manager at all. And what's really great... is Scott Baio is top billed in the film.
Yes.
He's got the top billing, even though he's essentially playing... He's basically Willie Ames.
Yes. Scott Baio is playing Willie Ames for a movie.
Yes.
And this movie really needed Willie Ames, but this movie wouldn't have been carried by Willie Ames. But he's playing Willie Ames.
Yeah.
And would then go on to have a career in which he'd have Willie Ames play Willie Ames to his Scott Baio, which is kind of amazing. His sister... Is it Catherine McCormick?
Maureen McCormick.
Maureen McCormick. Scott Baio's little sister is being played by fucking Marsha Brady.
Marsha.
So already, you're sitting there at home, you're getting giddy in your seat because I've just introduced you to a film with Scott Baio. Fucking, you know, Charles in Charge is the older brother to Marsha Brady, and they're going up against who? Patrick fucking Swayze. But hold on to your fucking roller skates.
That's not all.
That's just the beginning of the clusterfuck that is the amazing film.
That is the Escape
Town USA.
The tip of the Coke Mountain.
That is just the tip, baby. We are just giving you the tip right now. We're going to go full shaft here in a moment.
Well, I feel uncomfortable.
Before we go any further, we should mention, because this film, this is why we're so excited about this, because this, it's hard to believe that this thing even exists. Right. This was written by Nick Castle.
Nick Castle, better known as The Shape from Halloween. He was the first guy to play Michael Myers. He is the guy that directed fucking Last Starfighter.
He's the guy who co-wrote Escape from New York.
True story.
Like, so this guy, the guy, fucking Michael Myers, who co-wrote Escape from New York and directed The Last Starfighter, wrote this.
Oh, he wrote it. I guess. Ostensibly, it was written.
It was written, and the director threw half of it out.
Ah, okay.
And so he threw half of it out and said, fuck it, we're just going to ad-lib this. He threw out a whole chunk of the fucking script and said, we're just going to ad-lib it. And so what he did to ad-lib it was he called up a bunch of his friends who happened to be some of the biggest names in mainstream comedy in the 70s.
I do want to stop you right there. I agree with that, but what's weird, what's so, like, mismatched about this movie is that it's clearly trying to capitalize on a youth fan base who was just getting into roller disco.
Yes.
And yet the comedians they bring in are people like Flip Wilson and Ruth Buzzy.
Yep.
And, you know, like all of these people that I'm like, I don't hear like youth culture, even in the 70s, but, when you
but,
hear those
but
names.
That's what the rest of the film is filled with. And that's the thing. I mean, that's where Horseshack from Welcome Back, Kotter is Patrick Swayze's sidekick.
And kind of convincing as a tough.
Yeah.
Kind of convincing as a tough hood. More so even than Patrick Swayze.
And so the film is just littered with these pop culture oddities. You know, the unknown comic
shows up and does a bit of sketch. Okay, I was first introduced the unknown comic in an episode of Cheap Seats on ESPN Classic because he was doing like comedy at a Steve Garvey celebrity ski event. Yeah, go look up all those words I just said.
Yeah.
But he's terrible. He's one of the worst comics I've ever seen. I would put a bag on my head too.
He was really popular at the time. In fact, the funny thing is he plays two roles in the movie, and because that was his thing, was he would always go on as himself opening up for the unknown comic, and then he would come out as the unknown comic. He also plays the guy who has some of the better jokes in the movie. And here's where this movie is actually good. Because
I was wondering when we were going to get to that.
We were talking about all the just crazy misfires. The thing is when this movie wants to be funny, it can be really funny. Some of the gags and jokes in this fucking movie are really fucking like laugh out loud funny. Like they're still funny.
Yeah.
And like the audience, when I showed this for my birthday, was roaring at these parts. Like, and you're just stunned because you're like, this movie's bad. Why is it so funny? But there are moments that are really great. And,
the fact that Billy Barty.
We have yet to get there yet. So we've got all of these various comedians, and one of those comedians is Flip Wilson, who was a big TV star at the time. Mm-hmm. And he had this famous bit that he would do where he would play his own mother.
Geraldine.
So he plays the manager of this roller rink that is owned by his father, played by
Flip Wilson. Oh, no, the father's played by Billy Barty.
Billy Barty.
Yeah.
So many of you might remember Billy Barty as, well, he's a man of shortened stature.
He is a man that played the Orko replacement in the Masters of the Universe movie, Gwildor. He was also in Willow. Pretty much any movie that necessitates an actor of limited size.
Under the Rainbow.
Under the Rainbow, of course.
No,
absolutely.
You know Billy Barty, and he really fantastic comedian and actor.
Plays Screwball in Legend.
Yeah.
His Legend is an amazing film.
So this white
little person. I love how careful you're being right now.
I'm trying to be respectful, not careful, because you kind of, as crazy as this movie is, you kind of just want to go, so a midget is playing the dad to a black guy.
Yeah.
And
which sounds like your crazy racist uncle set up to a joke.
Exactly, except no. And, of course, Billy Barty is married to Geraldine.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to manage the show for the night while they're being threatened by Patrick Swayze and his roller skating band, roller skating gang, rather, to make sure that they win the event.
Because it's the most important thing on the planet. And if Patrick Swayze doesn't win the competition, he apparently murders people.
Apparently. But here's where this shit gets crazy.
Oh, here's where it gets crazy.
Patrick Swayze fucking owns this movie whenever he's on roller skates. You cannot take your eyes off him. The cinematography during his roller skating scenes and the work he does, you're just like, holy fuck. And then you see the hero go out and you're like, no fucking way is that guy in Swayze's league. He's not even close. But Swayze is cheating to make sure that he beats this fucking punk who isn't fit to shine his fucking roller skates. Swayze is just running the show in this movie. Just fucking up and down the boardwalk with this kid. And yet we're supposed to believe this entire time that this kid is really a threat to Swayze.
Yeah.
And the movie is just kind of even more nonsensical than that all put together. It is just a weird collection of almost skits woven together into this. Like it's almost like, thank God it's Friday, but even more absurd. Like, it's really strange how this movie
is. It's a schlockier version of schlock.
Except that when it wants to be really funny, it's funny as fuck.
Yeah, there is.
And the roller skating that they're trying to show off looks really cool.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack to the movie
is amazing.
So the parts that don't work and the parts that are just nonsensical are all the parts that you were talking about. The parts where they're trying to appeal to the youth culture. Because these people knew how to make a movie. They just didn't. And as many people have talked about in interviews, they knew the movie was going to be bad. And everyone was doing coke on set.
Yeah, like, Marie McCormick famously in her book was talking about how it was completely out in the open. She said, like a disco, there was a lot of cocaine being done on the set. Many people were open about it.
And this was the movie that made her fall off the wagon.
Mm.
She had gotten on coke, got off, and then this movie got her back on again.
Here's the story of a recurring drug addict. Yes. No, but I will say this. There are some really clever jokes. Like, there's a great gag where Flip Wilson, like, first of all, Flip Wilson's dad, played by tiny little Billy Barty, hits on every chick imaginable and is, like, successful at it, and it's crazy. But there's a great gag where he walks up to the check-in girl and tells her, like, you have to, like, don't listen to what my flirting father says. You have to actually take admission. And he says, if you go with his business practices, you're going to end up short. But if you stick with me, we'll end up in the black. And I'm just like, he got to say that, like, for real? That's really something he got to say? That's amazing.
There's actually a number of great jokes. In fact, one of the best series of jokes comes from one of the other oddities of this film.
Oh, my God.
This film is the very first speaking role of Dorothy Stratton. Now, most of you may not know who Dorothy Stratton is. You need to spend some time reading about her. She had a truly tragic Hollywood experience. She ended up murdered when she was very young. She was a Playboy playmate, I believe. She had a longtime relationship with Peter Bogdanovich. She was leaving her husband for Peter Bogdanovich. She was murdered by her husband. Peter Bogdanovich then went on to take care of her younger sister for a while, then ended up marrying her younger sister. Like, it is crazy Hollywood stuff. They've made two movies out of it, one of them famously Star 80.
Mm-hmm.
But this is her first speaking role, and she's just playing this girl trying to order a pizza in a bikini who is being hit on by
Leonard Barr.
No relation.
Who you may recognize as Shady Tree, the vaudeville type comedian from the James Bond film Diamonds Are Forever. And he's standing up there almost as if he's trying to see how many jokes he can fire off in a minute. Just like rapid fire vaudeville bits so fast that sometimes you miss the punchline. And she's literally just leaning over like, can I please just get my pizza? I'll take it frozen. I just want to get out of here.
And the thing is a lot of those vaudeville jokes are great.
They are. They're when you really can decipher funny. Them from like, he's literally just going a mile a minute. He's like,
he's like
John Machida of vaudeville.
and he's funny. And that's the weird thing about this movie is that scene, it's really annoying while it's going on. And every time Dorothy Stratton says, can I please have my pizza? You're just like pulling your hair out. And then the scene pays off.
Yeah.
And the second time you watch that movie, that scene plays totally differently. And you're really enjoying the humor of that scene. But the first time you're like, what the fuck? And then by the time it pays off, you're like, this is kind of fucking amazing. And the movie is just filled with that. And then it leads up to the amazing climax.
Yeah, after this battle between Patrick Swayze and Stan, all of a sudden they end up in a drag race across a pier.
On rocket skates.
It's a drag race not seen since the days of James Dean. It's basically Rebel Without a Brain Cell.
And just to top it off, what follows that scene is one of my favorite final lines in a movie.
Which
ever.
Is, of course...
well, all right, we'll spoil it, you know, because here's the thing about this movie.
Might as well just say.
Here's the thing about this. It's not available on DVD. It's not available on VHS. There are people who claim that they saw it on VHS as kids, but they may have been watching bootlegs of it because it was never officially released on VHS as far as anyone can find.
Yeah.
It is one of those mythical holy grails to find one of these things. You can only see it right now either on YouTube, which they somebody filmed with a video camera, a 16mm print of the movie, which kind of looks like ass, or the American Genre Film Archive has a beautiful fucking 35mm print of it.
I have seen Skatetown USA in 35mm, and there is nothing I can do about that. It is now in my brain forever.
Yeah, and it's kind of fucking amazing. Like, the thing is, you'll watch it in 16mm, because many of you will run to YouTube and watch it, because it's really the only way to watch it.
Yeah.
And you'll watch it and go, oh man, that, I kind of want to know what that looks in 35, if it might be beautiful. And the answer is yes, it is.
The answer is pure spectacle. It is absolutely amazing in 35.
So we have this rocket race.
Oh, yeah.
The rocket skates. We go off the pier. They're in roller skates going off the Santa Monica Pier. They're in the water. Patrick Swayze's drowning. The hero rescues him, drags him to shore. They're coughing, they're wheezing, and Patrick Swayze's like, man, I tried to kill you. You know, I cheated you. I harassed you. I even tried to kill you, and you saved my life. Why? And the good guy goes, because I'm the hero.
Yeah.
And boom. We're out.
End of movie.
And that's the end of the movie. And then we have the disco wizard, who turns out to have served as our puck for this fucking movie. Then going and explain, thanks for indulging us in our fantasy. Come out and check out Skate Towns opening up all across America, because this movie, we don't realize, is going to come out 3 months after the big disco explosion. And we're very sorry about that. But yeah, so he is our puck, explaining that clearly we've just watched a fantasy.
It's a Midsummer Night's Fever Dream is,
yes,
what we just watched.
And
see, here's the thing.
It's a Midsummer Night's Dream Saturday Night Fever.
Yes.
Dream. It's weird. He has just narrated the film for us, and oh yeah, by the way, yeah, we know that was fucking fantasy. It was ridiculous. We hope you had a good time. And once you kind of hear that line, you're like, how am I supposed to take any of this seriously and judge this movie as being anything but ridiculous spectacle selling us on how awesome roller disco is with a bunch of really funny comedians?
See, we need movies like this to understand the candle in the wind fad that was roller disco, the brief breath of life that it breathed before it was snuffed out forever.
This movie, it really is one of those things.
This and Xanadu.
Xanadu was another one that came out, and we've talked about that one already.
Yes, we have.
There is so much wrong with this movie, but there is so much right with this movie that you cannot ever really disparage it as being a truly despicable, terrible movie, because it is, it's really trying hard to entertain
it's
the
so
fuck
genuine.
Out of you.
It's so genuine, yeah, in its approach to being so off
the wall. And the parts that work, because try to take your eyes off Swayze,
nope,
while he's sexy belt dancing.
While he's dirty skating.
Watching this movie and seeing him in this movie, you realize why this guy all of a sudden started getting roles and became the huge star that he was in the 80s. Like, he was everything the 80s was looking for, and there he is, much like Sylvester Stallone, much like Arnold Schwarzenegger, playing a villain in one of his first roles before people realize how awesome and what a movie star he was.
Right.
It's like most of our heroes from the 80s started out playing villains in their early roles, and Swayze is no different. And this is,
it's a reverse Harvey Dent situation.
It is really one of those things you need to seek this one out and watch it on YouTube and watch it with friends and watch it with beer and give yourself over to it and say, I'm gonna have a good time with this. And you will. It is kind of crazy, and it'll become that film that you'll drag friends over to your house to fucking watch this with you.
Yeah.
Because it's that kind of movie. No one knew what I was showing the night that I showed it. Six people in the audience had seen it before, because they had seen it when it played the only time that the Draft House played it, 2 years before, on my birthday, oddly enough. It played on the exact same day as I played it 2 years before. And when I announced it, they lost their minds, and everyone else in the audience was just like, what the fuck are we about to watch? And then at the end, just watching everybody's heads just kind of pop, and like, I can't believe that was a movie.
Yeah.
And speaking of things we can't believe are actually movies,
we can't stop this episode without talking about the movie you showed for your birthday this year, which is the second gayest film I have ever seen, and that is Can't Stop the Music, otherwise known as the Village People movie.
Yes!
Can't stop the music, no matter how much you may want to.
You can't stop the music.
Nobody can stop the music. Yeah, this is, we don't do a karaoke podcast, but someday perhaps we will.
I call dibs on Thunderstruck.
Yeah, you know what? You know so much about the Village People, it is terrifying to me. I just want you to know that, like, on a human level, I am terrified. Not like I'm intimidated by your knowledge of the Village People. Like, I'm horrified by your knowledge of the Village People.
Well,
tell us about this movie, Cargill.
Okay. Okay, well, first of all, let me address this. My head is filled with tons of useless knowledge, and the story of the Village People is really a fascinating one, and that's why I know it, because it really is one of those great, fucked up, weird stories of success in which there's a guy named Victor Willis, and he was this little guy with this huge voice, and he and a producer got together when he was young, and they recorded a couple of songs, and they recorded them under the name The Village People, and they released the songs. They were San Francisco and I think I'm gonna make it in Hollywood. I forget what the title of that song is. And they were big hits. They climbed the charts, and all of a sudden, Dick Clark is calling saying, hey, we want to book the Village People. We want them to be on. And they're like, oh, shit, we have to put together a band, because he actually had sung all the parts on those songs.
It's not getting the band back together. It's getting the band together in the first place.
So what they did is they put out a call for need macho singers who can dance and also must have mustaches.
Yeah. This is boy bands before boy bands.
This is the putting together of a boy band, but a boy band specifically geared towards appealing to the disco era and this emerging gay audience.
Yeah.
It was the first time you had a real mainstream push to appeal to a gay audience that would then be suppressed, become a joke, and would become suppressed for another 15 years before gay culture would then, you know, burst out at the seams again, and we would have, you know, the Gen Xers, Gen Y, and millennials starting to push for a normalization of the way people were treated.
Yeah.
And but so here you have this bizarre band that was put together specifically so that they could put stereotypes in the background. And, you know, you
crank up the stereotypes. It's you can't stop the music.
You've got the cowboy, the construction worker, the leatherman, the cop, the GI, and the Indian, Felipe. And the Indian actually is half Indian, so it's not nearly as offensive as it seems, but he's half Indian and half Puerto Rican. So when the first time he shows up in the movie, you're just like, oh, fuck me. and the way these characters show up in this movie, essentially what this movie is, we have mentioned that it's the Village People, but we have not mentioned the real star.
The Goot. Steve Guttenberg.
A young Steve Guttenberg plays a young wannabe musician. He's a composer who's got all these great songs, but no band to sing them. Mm-hmm. And it was in an era when bands were writing their own songs, so he has to put together his own band. And so he hooks up with...
He hooks up with a supermodel.
Played by Valerie Perrin.
Yes.
And
otherwise known as Miss Tessmacher from the Superman
from and Superman, Superman 2. Yes, from 1 and 2. And has played a number of other movies. And she's been around. You see her and you're like, oh, I know this chick. And she's great. She's actually the star of the movie. Mm-hmm. But she's the only person in the movie that you're not going to remember the name, because her love interest is played by A young gymnast who has only appeared in two movies. And this young gymnast's name happens to be...
Bruce Jenner.
Bruce Jenner, the head of a certain clan of people that make America dumber just by existing. And he's been in only two movies, this movie and Jack and Jill, both movies, which won the Golden Raspberry Award.
The movies that invented the Golden Raspberry
this
Award.
This movie was shown back-to-back when it came out with Xanadu as part of a 99-cent double feature. And the guy who invented the Raspberry Awards went and saw this double feature and was so incensed by what he saw that he decided to invent the Razzies. It was this and Xanadu, and he invented the Razzies as a result. This was the recipient of the first Golden Razzie. And Bruce Jenner has only appeared in two movies, both of which have gotten the Golden Razzie.
Yeah, and oddly, this is a great film. This is kismet to follow Skate Town USA, because we mentioned that it like Xanadu, is a roller disco movie. Olivia Newton-John was actually the first person offered the lead in Can't Stop the Music, yes. And she turned it down to make Xanadu. She turned down a role in a terrible movie instead to make another notoriously terrible movie.
Which, both of which we love,
yes,
oddly
indeed.
Enough.
Oddly enough for us.
Oddly enough. So she's an aging supermodel who's just gotten out of the supermodel game and decides to help produce his career and help him put together a band. And this becomes the mythical half-true version of how the Village People were put together. Mm-hmm. Because in the true story, they already had the lead singer and the composer, and they were just looking for the backup singers. And in this version, they have to put together all of them. And as it turns out, these guys are all their own stereotypes. Felipe is always hanging out dressed up as the Indian. Mm-hmm. And he goes, hey, there's one scene where he's like, hey, I gotta go home and change. And the next scene you see him, and he's just got a different color headdress on. Like, right. It's the movie is filled with those kinds of absurdities. You know, the leather man is really a leather man, and the construction worker is a singer who sings on local ads dressed as a construction worker, and the cowboy just dresses the cowboy cuz. And oddly enough, even though it's the Village People movie, the Village People are kind of not really in it that much in the first two thirds of the movie.
It's almost as if they said, you know, who's not super great at acting is the Village People.
So what ended up happening was Victor Willis, who we mentioned before, who founded the Village People, wanted his role butched up in the movie. Mm. They were trying to have fun and play to the gay audience that this was geared at, and he wanted to assert his heterosexuality and have a girlfriend in the movie. They said no. The director, by the way, we'll get to that story in a minute, but the director fucked this movie up left and right. And said no. So Victor Willis not only left the movie, he left the Village People. And he was replaced by Ray Wilson. Is that his name? Ray? I want to say his name is Ray Wilson. And Ray Simpson, who went and then took the role of the cop. And then would sing with the Village People for a few years until Victor Willis would come back.
I just want to point out, listener, there are no notes in front of this man right now. He is going completely off the cuff, off the
when
top
there
of
ever
his head.
Note, whenever I fuck up, it's because I don't. I fly without a net here.
Right,
people.
But usually you're flying without a net about things that aren't the Village People. Like you're that's like an extra special layer of flying without a net.
So anyhow, look, I we joke, we have a lot of goofy fun with this kind of stuff, but the truth is, when I was in high school, my best friend came out of the closet. And we were 16 years old. We were living in small town Texas, and he came out of the closet, and my parents were like, you can't hang out with a homosexual. And it's like, fuck you, mom and dad. I will. And my rebellion was hanging out with my best friend and learning about the gay culture. And we would be the young twinks hanging out at gay clubs. And I learned very quickly, hey, I'm not attracted to men. I'm only attracted to women. And the Village People were still very much a part of that. And
which is odd, because as you've stated, and it apparently runs even deeper than that, the Village People weren't all gay.
No, yeah. No, they weren't. But as a product, they were geared towards
right.
a gay audience.
Right, right. So it was really more of a marketing thing.
Yeah. And so this movie plays that up. And it plays it up amazingly in a sequence that you can find on YouTube, their version of YMCA, one of the only songs from the film that actually were one of their hits. There's a number of hits you're going to find are missing from this, which is unfortunate.
There's a reference to Macho Man, but they don't actually sing it, and there's the Navy's not there.
There's a reference to San Francisco. Mm. There's a reference to a number of their songs, but the big ones they do, you know, the big one, of course, is YMCA. And so they do a lot of their newer songs. It was meant to promote an album. And so this movie goes into being a fictitious history of this band. And so the first two thirds of it, really kind of a wank fest between Perrin and Gutenberg, of who can get more screen time and be funnier, and neither quite succeeding because the writing on this movie is kind of terrible.
Well, yeah, especially since Gutenberg, you know, we always know him as like this kind of cocksure goofball.
Yeah.
But in this movie, he's so whiny and inept. It's different even for Gutenberg.
Yeah, no.
Like, we're used to Gutenberg from Police Academy.
Yeah.
It's like he's kind of an arrogant jerk, but he's also really lovable. In this, he's not arrogant at all. He's just a whiny bitch.
But he's also kind of lovable. He does bring the goot.
He's
a young actor fresh off the bus. Mm-hmm. You know, this is one of his first roles. It might actually be his first role. I'm not entirely sure on that. Because I know more about the Village People than I do Steve Gutenberg.
That is something that you just said.
Those are words that came out of my mouth.
Those are truth facts.
So they're doing what they can. And the problem with this movie, where this movie really falls apart, is this is a 90-minute movie that is actually 120 minutes.
Yeah.
There are 3 to 5 minute scenes in this movie that you're just like, you know, that you, if you have any internal editor at all, you're like, this should have gone. I didn't need this. Cut this. Like, it should have been trimmed down. If this movie were 90 minutes, if somebody made a fan cut of this that were 90 minutes long, this movie would be an amazing watch. Because once you get the Village People together, and once the Village People start doing their numbers, and the numbers start getting crazier and fucking crazier, this movie gets amazing. Like,
yeah.
They have a number that they do in here where they're ostensibly doing a commercial for the National Dairy Board. And it's called Do the Milk.
Do the shake.
And it's fucking hilarious. And it's crazy. And it's this huge stage, like 30 Styles, Busby Berkeley, almost like production with the Village People.
Yeah.
In the outfits that they do all of their stuff in, except white. So, like, Leatherman is in white leather, and the Indian is dressed in all, like, it's absurd, and it's amazing, and it looks fantastic.
It really does.
And projected in 35, it looked fucking gorgeous. And it's just like, and that scene that apparently they shot, it took them like a week to shoot it. They had 153 camera angles. Like, it was this huge expensive thing. This movie cost $20 million to make. It only made $2 million in the box office. The only place it was successful was Australia, where it was apparently a big hit. And every time I've mentioned it, Australians are like, oh yeah, it was a huge hit here. Like, Australians loved the Village People movie. No one else did.
It's got all these lines too. Just these lines of, like, there's like all these lead balloon comedic lines where it's like, burp, burp. And then it has lines that are so incendiary that you can't believe they just fucking said that. One of which being, there's like this oversexed Jewish best friend.
Oh my God.
Who has this line where she's like, every man she sees, like, despite the fact that they are all crazy gay, every man she sees, she wants to get with. And when she sees Indian, she says, I'm going to make up for all the indignities these people suffered. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, yeah, woman.
And the stuff that spills out of her mouth is kind of amazing. And then there's one actual great scene of comedy in this movie. There's actually one scene where, and it's weird, everybody has this weird reaction. When it happens, you're like, wait, all of a sudden you're like, whoa. Wait, that was like a legitimately great scene. What the fuck is going on here? And it's just kind of amazing. And then they go into another set of musical numbers.
It's like, no, go back.
But the thing is if you can give yourself over to the camp of this, because this one, in, you know, all three of these, you kind of have to enjoy for camp value, because their narratives, none of their narratives are strong narratives. None of them are particularly good narratives. They're all riffs on classic narratives that you know so well. that you really see how lazy their narratives are. But this one I find to be the campiest of the lot. And because the scenes of absurdity in it, just like there's the moment the Leatherman shows up.
Yes.
And the Leatherman shows up while they're holding auditions for the Village People. And he's actually there to get an extension on his taxes. And they're like, oh, no, we're hiring singers. He goes, singers, you ain't seen nothing. And he gets up on top of the piano.
And what does he sing?
Danny Boy.
And it's beautiful and heartrending.
And then it's a great joke.
Yeah.
Because Dr. Pepper paid for product placement in the movie.
He stops halfway through the final refrain, chugs Dr. Pepper, and then finishes the song.
And it's just, and the movie kind of knows what it's doing at times. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, this was directed by an actress who got a 3-picture deal. She was an aging actress. She got a 3-picture deal. This movie bombed so hard, they bought her out of the last 2 movies.
Yikes.
It's the only movie she ever made. She hated Valerie Perrin so much that they could not be in the same room together after a while. And so any scene that Valerie Perrin is in was directed by the director of photography.
Holy crap, I just realized that Nancy Walker is Rhoda's mom from Rhoda.
Yes.
I actually watched that as a kid.
Yeah, Rhoda's mom directed this movie.
Oh my God, I had no idea.
Yes, no, so Rhoda's mom walked off of set and let the director of photography direct Valerie Perrin, which is why her scenes are so all over the map.
Yeah.
Like, because she's not being directed. She doesn't have an actual director there going, hey, honey, bring it down this. Hey, honey, this isn't working. Let's go this way. Yeah. You know, none of that. Which, you know, actors need direction. You know, not every actor can just go in and go, fuck you, I'm going to own this. And so she's all over the map, and everyone, and even Bruce Jenner seems like he can act in every scene but one.
Every scene but one. Yeah, absolutely.
The opening to YMCA, like the opening to YMCA really feels like they were trying to find a gimmick to explain why they're going to a YMCA.
Yeah.
And it was almost like they had just given him the line and said, okay, we're going to have to explain this. And so he's just kind of winging it.
Yeah.
And you can't focus on how bad his acting is until the second or third time that you watch this, because you can't get over his half shirt and short shorts and the happy trail he's got rocking.
Yeah.
Like it's one of the most, of all the Village People's outfits, he manages to wear the gayest outfit in the entire movie.
He is the most fabulous in that scene. Absolutely.
It's just kind of like, wow, Bruce Jenner.
Way to go, buddy.
Way to go. And so, yeah, it's the movie is a weird train wreck. It's one of those things that I think would be far more classic and far more beloved if it were 90 minutes. But because it's not, it has those moments that, to borrow from what you said before, just kind of like lead balloons, where it's just kind of like, can we get back to the Village People, please? Can we get back to the Village People? Oh, good, the Village People are back.
Well, one of those moments, unfortunately, is the big finale where that song, Can't Stop the Music, goes on so long that you start to wonder, Can you ever actually stop the music?
And yet, at the same time, that's one of those taste things. Like, I actually love the fact that that scene goes on for 9 minutes and
there's so much
everyone.
Glitter. There's so much glitter in that scene.
There's so much glitter in that whole movie.
No, but that segment in that's
there's
segment
a scene where a construction worker smears himself with glitter for no apparent reason.
No, I'm sorry. That segment specifically looks like Rip Taylor Bukkake. Like, yeah. It is fucking everywhere.
It's kind of amazing.
And Can't Stop the Music has given us our junk food pairing this week better than any movie we have ever covered on this show.
Well, fuck yeah. Oh, wait. It's got to be the milkshake, do the shake.
Oh, no, it's better than that. It is Snowballs and a Ding Dong.
Oh,
yes,
my God.
It's a hostess buffet in honor of one of the most homoerotic lines in the entire movie, which is, and I quote, anyone who could swallow 2 snowballs and a ding dong shouldn't have any trouble with pride. A specific reference to the lead actress's dietary issues, but also serving as maybe a homoerotic joke. I don't know. It's kind of subtle.
Oh, no, no. I know.
It's real subtle.
It really, no, it's, there's no subtlety at all. No, that's actually one of the better moments of the movie. There's this great moment where, you know, because one of the jokes in the movie is she's not a supermodel anymore, so she can actually eat.
Yeah.
And so when we see her around, she's eating. She's making lasagna. She's eating, you know, biscuits. She's just chowing down on whatever's around. And she was talking about how bad she felt that she had 2 snowballs and a ding dong and on her way home. And so then that line comes up, but it's like, well, honey, anyone who can swallow 2 snowballs and a ding dong, you know, and it
shouldn't
just,
have any trouble with pride. So with pride, listeners, so. With pride, I want you to suck down two snowballs and a ding dong.
And if you need to wash it down, try a nice frosty vanilla milkshake.
Shake the milkshake.
Do the shake.
Do the shake.
Well, that was the thing that happened.
Well, we hope that you've been moved musically tonight by our selections. We hope you have enjoyed the show. I want to remind you yet again that you can find the show on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter, at Junk Food Cinema. Cargo, where can people find you individually on the interweb?
You can find me at Twitter, at Massawyrm, MassaWyrm, or at Facebook.com/Massawyrm.
You can find me at Bry Guy Salisbury, or Facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. And I gotta say, man, this is one of the most fun episodes we've done so far.
Well, I mean, these are my sick loves. You know, I love these movies. It was so much fun, because I believe I introduced you to both these movies, because I don't think you'd seen Can't Stop the Music before I showed it to you, had you?
No, I hadn't. So yeah, those two.
It was really one of those things where watching your reaction to both of those was just kind of amazing, and just watching my friends' reactions. And it's, you know, what I do is I end up having a party where we go to pinballs, we drink a lot of beer and wine, we play a lot of video games, and then we go over to the Alamo Draft House and we watch a crazy fucking movie that I always show something not to punish my friends, but that feels like at first it's going to be punishment, and then
but an incredible simulation of punishment.
But then turns out to be like, wow, I was totally, and because that's the thing is, I have this wonderful group of people here in Austin who are willing to give themselves over to something that most people wouldn't.
True story.
And what we also like to call the listeners of Junk Food Cinema, and so you guys were all there in spirit, but it was one of those things where just watching an audience of my friends give themselves over and go, all right, I'm fucking watching a Village of People movie, I'm in it, I better enjoy this. And then having everybody walking out, singing the songs, fucking laughing about the jokes, talking about how they can't believe they just had a good time, and wow, that was awful, but why did I enjoy the fuck out of that? Mm-hmm. And that's what all of these movies are to me. They're movies that they should not work. They fundamentally should not work, but for some reason they're so goddamn enjoyable, and I just love the hell out of them. I love what's bad about them, and I love what's great about them. I mean, the say what you will, the Village People and the Bee Gees were both really great, strong bands with an amazing amount of talent that, yes, they were mainstream pop and are identified with everything, you know, got tied into everything bad about those eras. But those were two talented fucking bands that churned out movies that really, really had some real talent behind it. And getting to see those in these films and see them try, because you know what? Say what you will, the Village People are giving it their fucking all.
They sure are. Absolutely.
And so are the Bee Gees. So, you know, if you've never seen these movies and you end up watching it, I apologize if you don't like it, but I hope to God you see what we see in these movies, and I hope to God you love them the way I do.
And if you do, definitely come back next week, or
actually 2 weeks.
2 weeks, because we've
got to take next week off, because this
Fantastic
week
Fest.
Is Fantastic Fest. Yes, baby.
Absolutely.
8 days of movies in Austin.
Oh my gosh. We're sorry, but it's time to go. But come back in 2 weeks for Can't Stop the Musicals Part 2. Until then, for Cargo, this is Brian reminding you that Leathermen don't get nervous.